Hi, this is Joe Mancuso, and you're in
New York City at the Harvard Club. Today is November 2nd, Election Day, 1993. And you're here for a meeting of the Chief Executive Officers Club. The good news is we've got a very full day today, and you've got a very entertaining luncheon speaker by the name of Dan Pena. Dan Pena is a entrepreneur extraordinaire, and we're going to have a lot of fun traveling to his castle in Scotland next spring, 45,000 square foot, 80 room castle. Dan Pena is going to talk to you today about a quantum leap. Enjoy, Dan Pena.
Thank you very much. I've been warned that this is the toughest crowd of the CEO Club group, and it's been recommended that I wear my hat or my face that I had when I used to live on 32nd and Lexington back in the early 70s when I was on Wall Street. But you don't look so tough to me, so I'm not going to do that, because the last time I gave the tough talk, which was at the management school, 50% of the attendees on a scale from 1 to 10 rated me at 11. 25% of the attendees said that they would never come back if I ever spoke again. If they saw me in the city, they would walk on the other side of the street. 25% said that I had a great deal of knowledge to put forth and to share, but they thought I was a little aggressive. Well, I am very aggressive, and I speak with a lot of passion. And what Joe has alluded to, I did take $820, and I turned it into $425 million. And of market capitalization, and in the process, I set a lot of goals and I fulfilled a lot of goals. And what we're going to talk about, which is really a combination of a lot of different talks I give. I have a talk, Do the Ends Justify the Means? And I have a talk, The CEO Sets the Tone. And I've got a talk about the CEO dealing with bankers, and they know because they just got up and left. I was one of the largest depositors in the Chemical Bank in Houston. And I was $80 million, and I yanked it out. So I guess they didn't want to hear that part of the story. I have a talk, Five Credos for Success. But we're not going to talk about any of those individual things. We're going to talk about a couple of things that have really become very prevalent since of my exposure to the CEO clubs and CEM and Smoking Joe, as I call him, Mancuso. And yesterday I was at the Harvard Club. They were very specific. They tell me in Boston, the. You are going to a Harvard Club tomorrow. Now, I don't even know if there are more than two Harvard Clubs. Are there?
No.
So I guess there's the.
And there's A.
There's the, and then there's A. And I guess you're A, so you're A on the list. So, I mean, but they made a big deal out of that yesterday. And not that I promised them that I'd tell you, but it's kind of reminiscent. I ran in the Boston Marathon in 1977. And it's hard to believe now since I've taken up weightlifting that I ran in the Boston Marathon. But I did, and I represented the Los Angeles Athletic Club, and I was part of a five-person team because we had one woman, and Mickey Gorman won the 77 Boston Marathon, and she was my teammate. She was a little lady, a little Japanese lady about this tall, weighed about 80 pounds. And so I had forgotten how Bostonians are. And even though I like the lobster, and I like some of the other things about Boston, they're erudite. It's tough to see the ground when you've got your nose in the air that far. But I had a good time, and Keith Kretschmer, who I used to work for a lifetime ago, about 20 years ago, who's a lifetime CEO Club member, I stayed with him, and we reminisced about a lot of old times and how Wall Street used to be and how it is today. But I want to ask a question. I've heard a lot of talk about retirement, working until I'm going to drop dead, which is your exit strategy is then dropping dead with your head falling over on the desk. I've heard a lot of talk about is business good or is business bad. I heard the chairman of one of the largest banks in the country talk about that we're going to come out of this, and that there's two basic elements to being an entrepreneur, and one is to have a dream and try to fulfill it, and one is to have the spirit to get out there and hustle and not be worried about a paycheck coming in and actually being responsible for yourself. And that's all well and good. But what my belief is, and some of the vignettes and stories that I'm going to say this afternoon, is a little different. I made my money when oil went from $40 a barrel to $8 a barrel. Because mine was a natural resource company. We're construction, coal, construction pipeline, drilling oil and gas, and I'm not an engineer, I'm not a geologist, I'm not a geophysicist, I know nothing. Which, what you can put on the head of a pin is what I know about the oil business. And I'm a finance guy, formerly from Wall Street. Supposedly a financial wizard of the 70s, Michael Milken and I went to school together. I just left Wall Street before I could get in trouble. I mean, basically. Otherwise, I didn't think Mike did such bad things myself, but and Mike and I, we went to high school together, and he went on to Berkeley, and I know him. And so what I'm here to say is that irrespective of the recession, I only know how to make money in a down market. I don't know how to make money in an up market. So what I'm about to talk about ought to be germane to everybody's business here. It ought to be germane, because I don't know. If I ever got in an up market, I don't know, I'd probably die. I have never made any money. It's not just one company that I've built. The methodology and the precepts and what I call pennyisms that we're going to talk about, I built three companies. I built one, two, and when I talk about companies, it's not the volume or revenue. People talk about a $20 million company, they normally mean $20 million in revenue. When I talk about the company, it's either what I sold it for or what the market value was on a public stock exchange. I built in 1 year a $2 million company. It was my first company. It was in the real estate business. And it was during the early 70s in the recession. I didn't know you couldn't sell real estate in a recession. Nobody told me that when I was going to graduate school. Second company I built was a $50 million company, and it was a marketing company, refining company in the oil and gas business. And the third company I built, that was in 3.5 years. The third company I built in 8 years was Great Western Resources, which if you go to Houston today, and you go to 1111 Bagby, and you push the elevator, and you go up on the 17th floor, and you go in there, and we have 44,000 square feet of office space, and the company's still there. It's viable. It's one of the most successful natural resource companies in the United States. It's just I'm not running it anymore. And what Joe had alluded to a little while ago is true. They ultimately, my partners, the Kuwaiti government, decided I shouldn't be there anymore, and they threw me out in January 1992, and just 5 weeks ago, I won a $6 million judgment against them for wrongful termination, which we're in the process of hopefully settle in, and I should get a nice fat check here in the next week or two. Chemicals should have stuck around because a $5 or $6 million deposit ain't chicken feed, you know. And as an aside, for 15 months all my assets were tied up in a constructive trust. A judge in Houston, Texas, decided that there was enough possibility that all their charges, 32 charges against me, were true, that they tied all my assets up. And if you have an overhead as big as mine and you can't write a check, you can't sell a stock, a bond, you can't leverage your houses, you can't do anything. For 15 months I lived with no assets that were liquid. I learned what kiting means. I didn't know that concept about writing a check when there's no money at the other end. I didn't understand that because I had never done that to build a business. I did plenty of it to survive for 15 months. Now that's all behind me because all my assets are freed up and my bankers all love me. Everybody's happy. Now if I had lost the lawsuit, you can just imagine where I'd be. I mean, they'd be standing here right now trying to take my cufflinks off. But the thing that I believe in very strongly, and the thing that Turner, Gates, Jobs, more recently Richard Scott, the guy that's doing all the healthcare acquisitions you read about, $9 billion in 45 days, well, Rick Scott used to be my lawyer. Rick Scott used to sit on my right side or my left side doing deals. And he wanted to make as much money as I did. And I said, the only way you do that, Rick, is you get your ass out there. He lives in Fort Worth, still does, still married to the same high school sweetheart he married when he was 19, and you got to do deals. And he went out and started doing deals, and he hooked up with Richard Rainwater of the Bass fame and has made a lot of money. And so, but the thing that all those guys believe, and Rick Scott, his first year in business, when he left me, he did $45 million in business. That was 1988. Next year, it's estimated he's going to do $10.4 billion in revenue. Because I believe, as those guys believe, that you can have quantum growth. You can have geometric growth. You can have exponential growth. Most of us have been trained, and wrongly, that you have to have arithmetic growth. I heard somebody comment this morning that he's interested in making a lot of money now. I think it was one of the gentlemen, I don't think he's here now, in the accounting business, because in his early years he was interested in building a business. Now he wants he and his fellow partners to clean up, basically, is what he said. Well, where I differ is I clean up from the beginning. I don't wait to the end, because I may die. My exit strategy, the first time was going public. On my 39th birthday, I went public. I took an option on $60,000 worth of oil property, and I turned it into $50 million in 3.5 months. I plan on cleaning up in the beginning because I believe very strongly you got to pay yourself first, and I don't mean me personally, but your employees, everybody, from the top to the bottom, from the beginning, because if in fact your strategy is that we're going to cash in 3 years down the line, 7 years down the line, 10 years down the line, a lot of things happen. They're called economic cycles. And then you get down to that 3, 5, or 7, or 10 year period, and you have dissipated all your retained earnings. There's a guy in the CEO Club in Los Angeles says that in the last 5 years, he has dissipated 25 years of net worth accumulation and retained earnings all in 5 years. He's given it back. Now, intellectually, I know he ought to turn the key and close the business down. Yet when I said that in Los Angeles, it was like a turd in a punch bowl. These people looked at me like I was some sort of Nazi, Hitler. I mean, like, or Mussolini or Stalin. I said, I mean, it's as plain as the mustache on your face, I told him. You got to turn the key. After the meeting, or during the cocktails before lunch, he took me aside and says, yes, I just don't have the balls. I can't do it. I can't do it. Now, I don't know how many of you fall into that category. And ladies, excuse me, I don't mean to offend anybody when I use graphic examples like that. But what I want to talk about is this. Let's just for a moment pretend, and for those of you that have heard me speak, you've heard this little analogy, that we've all got 100 IQ today, okay? For some of you, I'm giving you a little. For some of you, I'm taking away. And for this example, let's just pretend that I have 100 IQ. I'm giving myself a little. Okay. If we've got 100 IQ, is it possible for anybody to have 10 times higher our IQ? 10 times smarter than us, 1,000?
No.
No. I've heard of 200 IQs, I've heard of 220s, I've even heard of a 240 one, but I've never heard of 1,000. So if somebody can't be 10 times smarter than us, can somebody work 10 times harder than us? No, not really. Well, then why are there people that make 10 times more than you? Why? Why are there people that make 1,000 times more than you? Why? That's part of it, no? They think bigger. They think bigger. I didn't like Ted Turner until I heard him talk recently about goal setting. And I mean, I'm 48 years old and I've had a lot of success, thank God. But when I heard him say this, that the one thing that his dad gave him, in addition to leaving him a couple $1,000,000 when his dad died, was he says, son, set goals that you can't achieve, cannot achieve in your lifetime. I realized why I've only got the money I've got. I'm a small thinker. I think small, or I thought small. Now I've changed my whole idea. When I started Great Western Resources with $820, a leased fax machine, and a phone in my spare bedroom in my house, I set two goals. One, I wanted to be in the top 5 income earners for energy executives in the United States, and I wanted to have a $2 billion company. I fell $1.55 billion short on the company, but for 5 years running, I was in the top 5. 1 year, I was the top 1. Highest paid energy executives in the United States. What if I had set the goal for $20 billion? Where would I have been today? $10 billion. That's right. From your lips to the Lord's ears, ma'am. Now, if I can just, after all the preconditioning that I've been through, because I've been on this earth, let's call me 50 for right now. My wife doesn't like this analogy. Let's call me 50. And if you take 24 hours times 365 days and you figure it all out, I've been on the earth about 470,000 hours of preconditioned thinking. So for those of you that are 25, the ladies, 25 to 30, you just multiply out the hours and figure out how many hours you've been around. For you, the guys that are a little older than me, that's a lot of hours. And what we've been taught historically is that preconditioned thinking can't be changed. We have all these misconceptions. One of the misconceptions is that cost control is the most important thing in a business. That's baloney. It's revenue. You can never have too much revenue. It's just like you can never have too much success. It's revenue. It's the most important thing for a business that's beginning. And I'm here to tell you, revenue is the most important thing for a business that's continuing to grow. But a lot of us in this room choke our business to death with cost controls. A lot of people in this room choke our businesses to death because we're freaks of nature that have to control. We're control freaks. When I learned, when I was 31 years old in 1976, that I became, went from a micro thinker to a macro thinker, I've made all my money. Micro to macro. My wife tells me that I was depressed once in 24 years that we've been together, married 20 years. I can't ever remember being depressed, but she says on my birthday in 1976, I was 31 years old, I was sitting on a staircase with my two Great Danes, with a bottle of Jack Daniels, and my two Great Danes were licking the tears up out of off my cheeks. Now, I remember that, but I don't remember it being depressed. What I remember is that I was 10% into my 40s, and I had not accomplished 10% of what I wanted. And I said, Jesus, I'm going to have to hump like hell for the next 9 years to get to where I want to go. I then had a life-changing experience. And by the way, I would recommend two books to everybody. And you've heard them before, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. Everybody's heard that. And another one's a book called Release Your Brakes by Jim Newman, who founded the organization called the PACE Organization. Jim Newman's semi-retired. In fact, I'm attending his seminar next week in Palm Springs. And I attended his seminar in Palo Mesa, California, in 1976, and he made me understand why I hadn't been as successful, and it's because I had not become comfortable with success. And forgive me again for those of you that have seen this, but if those were $1,000 bills, and I put a 2x12 here, all of us could walk up and down a 2x12 and pick up the $1,000 bills all day long. No, thank you. Now, just imagine if this 2x12 was 50 stories up. Is there anybody in this room that could go across and pick up a $1,000 bill? Maybe one, okay. Now let's say that your child, your loved one, I used to say spouse, but nobody go across it. And let's say we threw gasoline on your spouse. Nobody'd run, but we threw gasoline on your grandkid or your kid, and a lot of us had struggled across there somehow. That's why you read about women that can lift cars off people, you know, when the car flips over on somebody. It's comfort. Most people aren't more successful because they are not comfortable with the trappings of success. I walk 50 stories up. Ted Turner and Rick Scott walk 100 stories up. Most people walk in the cellar because they think, well, geez, if the wind, it was windy this morning, right? The wind could probably knock me off that board, even if it's on the ground, and I may fall over and twist my ankle, and then I couldn't get to work. It's comfort. The air's thin up here. I think that's where the thing Blue Bud came from. The air's thin up here. There's not a lot of people up there. And whoever said that it's more difficult to stay on top than get there, that was a smart guy or smart lady, whoever said that. Because that sure as hell is true. Ted Turner, do you think he's comfortable where he is? Of course he is. Do you think Ted Turner cares what you think? I happen to know Ross Perot. Do you think Ross Perot cares what you think? He only cared a little bit when he was running for office. I don't care what you think. I tell people, if you want a friend, buy a dog. I don't want to be your friend. I don't want to be your friend. I got plenty of friends. Friends are problems. But the comfort, the thinking big is the difference. Another example, because quantum theory or quantum thinking, exponential growth, is not a change in your whole life. It's a marginal shift in effort to get a geometric result. Another example, the Blue Jays just won the World Series. I happened to have the misfortune of being in Toronto that night, trying to catch a plane. Or actually, in Toronto, to give a seminar, and nobody wanted to hear me talk. And they paid me $995 a head for one day, and they still wanted to watch the World Series. But right now, if you bat 250, you're going to make $300,000 or $500,000 a year playing professional baseball. If you bat 350, you're going to make $3, $4, $5, or $6, or $7 million a year. Roughly accurate. That's one hit for 10 at-bats difference. That's a marginal shift, 10%. Most of you fish with fishing poles and, no, most of you fish with a string tied with a line and a hook at the end of your finger. Some of you fish with fly rods, I fish with nets. Ted Turner, Gates, all the guys that I just mentioned, which I don't agree with all these guys, but one thing I do agree with, that they're all successful. And they've all done it the same way. None of these guys are reinventing the wheel vis-a-vis what they're doing. They may have different products. One of the things that I always talk about is Alexander Graham Bell, who's one of my great idols, was, until I found out it took him 25 years and 10,000 experiments to invent the phone. Now, I'm a pretty persevering guy. I don't say no to anything. I can overcome anything. I don't care what it is. But I don't think I would have lasted 10,000 experiments. I would have paid some inventor, like the guy that was in Boston. I would have paid him, hey, you work on it the next 6 or 8 years. I mean, I wouldn't have waited 25 years and 10,000 experiments. I hear people talk about that they don't get financing. They didn't get the financing because I won't ask the question how many of us need more capital to grow because I know the answer. Again, the bankers left. Did you tell them what I was going to talk about? Is that why they left? And I talk about how many financial institutions did you go to? And I do some consulting. And they said, we went to two. We went to one. I'm here to tell you there is a financial institution either in the United States or someplace in the world that will finance every Rufus funky deal in this room. There is. And I make the analogy, I taught for 1 year at where I went to undergraduate school, and I didn't do it the next year because I was so disappointed in the youth of America. We're lucky the Iron Curtain fell. And we're lucky that communism didn't work because the kids that are coming up in this society, at least the college students I taught, lack a lot of one desire, motivation, and a lot of other things. But the example I give is when I ask the kids, they give you a class on how to get a job, how to write a resume. I didn't realize that. They didn't have that when I was going to school. And I asked the kids, well, how many have you had job offers? Nobody. How many resumes did you send out? 6, 8, 10. In the room, the highest was 30. A friend of mine named Mayor Fidel Vargas, he's the youngest mayor in the United States. He's 23 years old. He went to Harvard undergraduate, and in between Harvard undergraduate and graduate school, he went home and he decided he was going to run for mayor in a little town called Baldwin Park, Los Angeles, California, outside L.A. I said, Fidel, mayor, how many resumes did you send out? 700, Mr. Pena. 700. How many job offers did you get? One. My students wilted like the bone marrow came out of them because the whole class hadn't sent 700. There is a financial institution someplace in the world that will fund all your funky deals, I'm telling you. No person that I know has called on more financial institutions than I did. From Bangor, Maine, to San Diego, from Miami, to Seattle. I raised just short of $1 billion in equity and debt when I was going Great Western, when oil went from 40 to 8. When they said money couldn't be raised. And we grew through acquisitions, because I figured out right away I didn't know how to find oil. I mean, I figured that out in about 6 months after drilling 25 or 30 dry holes. So, I mean, I thought people only lost money in tax shelters that couldn't find it. I didn't know the real business was you couldn't find oil. I mean, I figured that out like that. I mean, although I had a lot of people on the staff that analyzed, and they'd still be analyzed, and we'd be out of business, because one of the things I learned when I went from micro thinking to macro thinking is perfection equals paralysis. Perfection equals paralysis. Too many people in this room, too many people in industry pound numbers to death, especially with computers now. You can figure, you can turn numbers upside down, you can do a million permutations on deals now. And that's now, I can assure you, Ted Turner, and these guys, I don't want to keep mentioning their names, they don't analyze. 99 times out of 100, your first instincts are right. 99 times out of 100. 99 times out of 100, conventional wisdom is wrong. Conventional wisdom is wrong. It's like, I know that I'm not going to change my parents, I'm not going to change my in-laws. So I don't waste time on things that I can't change. I just don't. My parents and my in-laws, especially my in-laws, are going to be that way. They've been that way for 24 years, and they're not going to change. They've lived in the same house 68 years. So, and now it's a slum, and you got to carry a gun down there, and God protects them down there. They're in their late 80s. Somehow, they don't seem to get hurt. So, but it's the same way in business. it's easier to make money if you don't have to change something that you probably aren't going to be able to change at all. There are certain banks, there are certain financial institutions that will never do business with me because of my outrageous precepts of business. Number one, if the bank doesn't want to finance it, I want to do it. By definition, because I've never met, with one or two exceptions, a rich banker. Okay, by definition, if my lawyers don't like it, I want to do it. If my accountants don't like it, I want to do it. Accountants and engineers have the hardest time for quantum thinking because they're trained. Lawyers are next. Accountants, engineers, accountants, lawyers, and that, they're kind of like a line. Doctors, I mean, they can't do anything right. I mean, that's why they invest so much, are losing so much in investment. But it's not impossible to change that preconditioned thinking. And then when you think about it, accountants, lawyers, and engineers normally have, well, not so much engineers unless you have advanced degrees, have the most education. They've had to be trained the most. So it's tough to get that preconditioned thinking, you know, to there used to be a saying back, our former president, Teflon Ron, used to sell Boraxo soap on 20 Mule Team in the 50s. I don't know if anybody remembers the commercials. Well, that Boraxo soap would take the hide off you. So in the old days when I sold real estate while I was in college, by the way, in 1969 when I was still going to college, I had the highest closing ratio of any real estate salesman in the country. I had a 94.6% closing ratio. You either bought or you left dead. I mean, there was no in between. I mean, you either bought or you died. I mean, you either went out in a box or you bought from me. That was. But what I learned is I had an old sales manager named Kelly Norwood, who was a Bolt Hall, which is Berkeley's law school, disbarred lawyer, who was my sales manager. And he says, Penna, you got a Boraxo, they're brain clean. In other words, in new computer parlance, we had to erase their data bank. You had to make them forget. And he says, you gotta have vision that there's really a lake there in Havasu. There wasn't any lake at the time I was selling it. You gotta have vision. You gotta see the little dots, the sails across it. You gotta, and what we have to do as individuals is a lot of the thinking that we've had and been trained from the time we were in grade school forward is wrong. It's wrong if you want to make a lot of money. It's okay if you just want to be okay. One of the things, and normally I get people's attention, is next time you know, because it's hard to stay focused. We all know that. And one of the things I want you to try to remember as I speak now, remember the passion you had when you first started your business? How excited you were, get up in the morning, want to get there. And then over time, you've gotten beaten down. Over time, Jesus, God, I wish it was Friday. And it's Tuesday. I wish it was Friday. Because time beats you down. But just think of what, for the rest of the time I'm up here, just think about that passion. Try to think of that passion that you had when you couldn't wait to get to work. You wanted to work late because you knew you were growing your business. Because at the beginning of your business cycle, you're growing geometrically, by definition, because you're coming from ground zero. You can extend those cycles. But when you, next time you lose focus, think of it this way. When you lose focus, you're letting not only yourself down, your business down, but your family down. Now, I've never met one single person I've ever talked to that wanted to do less than their best for their family. And I've met some hard SOBs, but nobody wanted to do less than the best they could for their family. Everybody wants to do the best. So when you start to lose focus next time, just think about, don't think about your business. Don't think about letting yourself down. You're letting your family down. You're letting your grandkids. You're letting your kids. Your wife. Some of you don't care if you let your spouse down. But anyway, pretend that it matters whether you let your spouse down or not. But just every time that I start to lose focus, which isn't very often, I think about what I call the children from hell, my three children. Dan Jr., who's just like me, like I spit and he grew up, and he's only not quite 12. It's frightening to think there's a 12-year-old me running around the country. Derek Stewart, 10 years old, just like me. Kellyanne, a girl. Like Dan Pena, my God. What's the world going to be like when she grows up? But whenever I do lose focus, I think of those three little kids, and it just makes me work harder, send faxes at 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. When I do business with people, They have to have a personal fax machine at home, because I want to be able to get a hold of them at night, 3 o'clock in the morning, whenever. And some of the people that have approached me since I started doing this in the last year, they want to be my partners, they want to be, you know, and I always make the first appointment where they've got to fight traffic. New York's got big traffic. I thought it was in Boston. New York's got big traffic. So Southern California's got big traffic. You're going to have to fight traffic. I like to make them fight traffic both ways to see if they'll do it. If they won't make an appointment with me that they got to fight traffic, I don't want to have anything to do with them. That's a red flag. Forget it. I don't care what your deal is. Because when we got to suck up our pantyhose and it gets tough, I mean, if you're not even willing to fight traffic, what are you going to do when it gets tough? So I have this little checklist, which is part of my seminar, that I go through, that 1, traffic, 2, meeting on weekends, 3, Saturday nights. You're not willing to do those 3 things, you're not doing business with Dan Pena, and you're not doing business with anybody that I advise. Now you just think to yourself, some of you in this room aren't willing to do those 3 things now. Mike Milken's first meeting was at 3:15 in the morning. Second meeting was at 4:15. His last meeting was midnight. I have to sleep more than that. I mean, I can't live on 2-3 hours sleep. I mean, I got to sleep at least 6 hours. The older I get, they say when I get real old, I'll need less sleep. Maybe that'll be good. But it's about focus, and it's about not letting yourself down. And this is the thought process that these guys go through. Now, one of the things, and it's important to realize, super success isn't for everybody. And one of the things, I forget the guy's name at the management course, CEO management course at Laguna, he said it best. He got up at the end during the closing moments of my final talk, and he said, "Dan, you made it me feel all right to know at least I don't have to go out and kill the world." Because one of the things that I do say, and there used to be a book, still is a book, called I'm Okay, You're Okay. It was written in the early 70s, which basically said, you know, I'm okay, you're okay, whatever you want to do is all right, and you know it, whatever I want to do is all right. And it's the same in business. You don't have to be a Dan Pena or at that end of the continuum. What I try to do in my coaching is I try to get you just an inch closer to my end of the continuum. Because even an inch closer is going to make you more successful, it's going to make your business grow, it's going to get you more focused. One of the key ingredients, somebody asked me earlier, what are the 2 things that differentiate, that's not how you put it. What was the question you asked me, the 2 things? Yeah.
You had said to me that the number one question people ask you is, how did you do it?
Yeah.
And I said to you, well, I know you did it, so I wouldn't be concerned about that. My question would be, how would you do it if you were my business?
Okay.
Specifically my business.
Okay, well, and the methodology is the same. I've built companies and I've helped other companies build, irrespective of the industry. The only thing that I'm really weak on is manufacturing. But I mean, the principles of management are the same, but I don't know anything about manufacturing. Closest I know about anything about manufacturing is coal mining, which has nothing to do with manufacturing. But the biggest differentiation and the thing that has to be, in my judgment, of paramount importance to you is staying focused. Most people that have been successful in this room probably have diversified into other things. See, conventional wisdom says you should diversify so you can lessen your risk, lessen your exposure. That's wrong. You want to do more of the same. Because contrary to what was alluded to earlier, companies only go out of business because they're mismanaged. This baloney about, well, interest rates went against me, health care, laws are changing, it's all crap. It's because they're mismanaged. Yet, the 99,000 companies that went out of business filed Chapter 11 or 7 in the last 12 calendar months. You can talk to those CEOs, those entrepreneurs, and every single one of them is going to say that something went against them, interest rates. That's not true. It's because they've been mismanaged. It's because either their strategy was wrong, it was implemented wrong. I would rather have a weak plan that's implemented with enthusiasm than a dynamite plan that's not implemented at all. I bet you a lot of you in this room have great plans, but they're implemented with less than great enthusiasm. I mean, who would you rather do business with? Who would you rather play sandlot football with? An enthusiastic guy that says, "Throw me the ball, John. I can beat the SOB in the flat. Throw me the ball, John." Or, "Well, there's a 50-50 chance that, you know, it is raining and the water, it could slip through my fingers. Who are you going to throw the ball to?" It's the same in business. You go into your banks. I walk in with a client one day. In fact, we turned around. The closer we got to the elevator, the more we got. And I said, come on, Henry. We're not going. We're canceling the meeting. Because I'm not going to go in there like that because you're going to shake hands and you got water in your hand. I mean, because you're perspiring because you're so nervous. So we went back. We canceled the appointment. I told him we had a flat tire and we couldn't make it. And then we came back again because business is the same way. I mean, you want to show your best foot, not your worst case. One of the things we did as kids, and when I go through this analogy, when I had my first date, I just had my 30-year high school reunion, and the girl that this analogy is about, I saw, who, you know, she looks like my mother now, but yeah, when I would practice as a junior in high school to ask her out, I got in front of a mirror, and I said, Judy, would you like to go to the dance with me? And when I used to practice things to ask my dad, she always said no, but I practiced a lot. We used to do things like that when we were kids. We practiced. Athletes practice. Practice makes perfect. Whoever said that was smart. Why do athletes practice? How many of you practice being successful? How many of you practice calling on banks? If I still practice, and Rick Scott still practices, I mean, why wouldn't you want to practice? There's no answer. I practice, even though this isn't one of my set talks, I practice in my own mind the 8 or 10 points I wanted to cover. You know, macro to micro and the various things that I've gone through. And I'm an accomplished speaker. But I practiced. I practice when I'm going to go make a presentation, when I first made my presentation to the Kuwaiti government. First time I made my presentation to the Israeli government, which I think is worth repeating. In 1983, I wanted to do business with the Israelis because I thought that if I could find oil in Israel, because I was looking for a quick way to get a grand slam. I said, if I could find oil in Israel, and I'm not Jewish, I would have accolades so great that, I mean, I'd have to hire secretaries just to keep track of them. So I finagled a way to get invited by the then Minister of Energy, Modiei, who was a lawyer. And Minister Modiei sent me a nice invitation, and we flew over there, and my two partners and I flew TWA coach. I still remember how much a ticket cost. From Los Angeles to Tel Aviv, round trip was $3,300 for the three of us. I hired a high-priced consultant who flew first class from L.A. to New York, Concord, New York to Paris, the rest, first class from Paris to Tel Aviv. $10,000 round trip. So we got $13,000 invested plus hotels, and one of the interesting things is that I met Mark Spitz. He was there. He was selling some deal. I forget what it was. And you talk about practice. I mean, how long did he practice to get those 7 or 8 gold medals that he got? So we're in front of Mr. Modiei, and we get done with our about 40-minute presentation. And he said, with the greatest respect, Mr. Pena, why should Armin Hammer, who was here yesterday, by the way, at that time I didn't know Armin Hammer was Jewish. I didn't know he was Jewish. Armin Hammer was here, Occidental Petroleum, Superior Oil, and they named all these huge companies that, you know, if anybody can find oil, and there's a lot of jokes about why do the Arab countries have oil and why Israel doesn't, I mean, it's just across, I mean, there's all kinds of stories, especially in the oil business, which is a good question. I mean, I've asked myself 1,000 times, why, just a matter of just 1,000 yards. So he says, why would we pick you? Little company, the company was called Great Western Energy, which was one of the subs that we had at the time. Now, I thought real quickly, and this is about enthusiasm, I said, he's right. I didn't say this, I'm thinking, he's right, what am I going to do? I jumped up and I said, and the bodyguards all got nervous when I jumped up like this, and I'm wearing suits like this, and they're wearing cutoff, and it's hot. And I said, with the greatest respect, do you know the difference between chicken shit and chicken salad? And he steps back, and then it seems like an eternity, maybe it's 6 or 8 seconds, he says, yes, I do know the difference. And I says, Mr. Minister, I mean, you've been dealing with the chicken shit, and I am the chicken salad. He instantly pointed to Dr. Barak, who was a PhD from MIT, managing director of the Israeli National Oil Company, said, cut a deal with Mr. Pena. He says, I think he's got just the right chutzpah. He may just find us oil. Unfortunately, 6 weeks later, the Lebanese war broke out. They invaded Lebanon. And I mean, their $60 million budget went to zero. And they because that money went into the funding the war, and that never happened. But it was the enthusiasm that I put forth. Of course, one of my partners was Jewish. She just slid under the, wanted to get under the carpet. And we went forward, and for 6 or 8 months, we acted as if the deal was still going to come to fruition, even though we knew that the Israeli National Oil Company wasn't going to fund the deal. And we acted as if we had no limits to our abilities, which is one of the things that I preach to people. My young son, first year in Little League, he batted 640 this year. 640. Now, see, December 8th last year, my two sons asked me, "Dad, we want to play baseball." It's a really important point. It's about preconditioning. They had played cricket. We had lived in Scotland. So I bought them baseball gloves, mitts, and all this stuff, and I got a book on teaching Little League or coaching Little League. I never played baseball. I played football and golf in high school and college. So at where I live, at the castle in Scotland, I measured out a diamond. I didn't know Little League diamonds were smaller than regular diamonds. And so they couldn't throw the ball from center field to anything. I mean, barely over second base. When they went to practice or when they went for the tryouts, the kids threw the arm like Brooks Robinson, who Baltimore Orioles for a long time ago. I mean, they had my young son was the only kid in his league that could throw somebody out from home plate to second base. They had arms like bazookas because they were conditioned. Derek batted 640